This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Barely into the new news year, and it's been dramatic. An assassination of an enemy general, just because. An exchange of apocalyptic threats. A missile barrage toward U.S. troops in reprisal. And a public finding itself bracing for war.
Crowds on the streets of Tehran. Anger growing over the U.S. airstrike that killed the head of Iranian special forces.
Ballistic missiles soaring into the night sky. Their targets, two Iraqi military bases housing thousands of U.S. soldiers.
At the moment, this is being recorded on Friday, both Iran and the United States seem to have backed down. But the situation remains tense as Congress ponders how to keep an erratic president in check and the rest of us try to sort out how we got to the brink of another ruinous regional war. Some spoke of a childish president frustrated when protesters in Baghdad broke Benghazi-like into the heavily guarded U.S. embassy on New Year's Eve. Some spoke of inevitability following 40 years of Iran-sponsored terrorism. And others turned a phrase.
Do you think the president was doing the proverbial wag the dog?
Wag the dog. The construction dates back to the 1860s, but it took on a new meaning in the 1997 Barry Levinson film called Wag the Dog.
Just got to distract him. Got less than 2 weeks till the election.
What in the world would do that? What in the world would do that?
Well, I'm working on it.
The movie president is embroiled in a sex scandal amid a tense re-election campaign. So, to change the subject, his handlers stage a fake war with Albania, knowing that in wartime, the public and press will line up behind the commander-in-chief. So, yeah. Of course, movies are pretend. A real war with Iran promised actual catastrophe. But administration hawks and their media proxies nonetheless got busy trying to win the hearts and minds of the American public using the same techniques deployed in the run-up to deadly fiascos in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Certainly Nathan Robinson, editor of Current Affairs magazine, had seen it before, beginning with the government making misleading claims and the media running with them.
Some of us remember the New York Times was widely criticized for this reporting in the lead up to the Iraq War because the New York Times would run headlines like Saddam intensifies his quest for A-bomb parts or nuclear weapons parts, says U.S. Technically, there's nothing wrong about that headline. The U.S. does say that. But of course, we trust the media to have vetted the information, that they've actually got some reason why they think it's credible enough to put it in the newspaper. Unfortunately, that's often not true. So I just saw an example of this. Vox was writing an article that was very critical of what a U.S.-Iran war would look like. It said it'd be a disaster. But they said, as a fact, Iran has killed 600 Americans. Well, when you click the link, it's a Military Times article saying the Pentagon says Iran has killed 600 Americans. But the Pentagon says part then disappears in the repetition. And that's what you saw on Vox. And it was pointed out to them, and they've now changed it to say the Pentagon says. But you really got to watch out for this stuff.
But it doesn't take someone in Trump land to confuse the issue. Here is Democratic Congressman Gregory Meeks on CNN.
I have not seen any strategy on behalf of this president. That's what bothers me.
That's what bothers him, not the assassination per se. Because on both sides of the aisle, the conversation begins with the presumption that if it serves American interests, it is our right and duty to kill him. But you dispute that calculus.
you have to go deeper and ask, well, strategy for what? America presumes that the pursuit of nothing more than its own self-interest, with no regard to the interests of other countries, is a reasonable objective. And I don't think that's self-evident. A lot of people are going to be saying, well, the president was impulsive, he didn't follow the right process, there should have been strategy. But they need to ask a deeper question, which is it acceptable for the United States to assassinate foreign officials? And what is the standard? Can anyone do this? Under what circumstances is it reasonable to take an action like this?
Most of the Democratic presidential hopefuls seem to be criticizing Trump.
Bernie Sanders is the only candidate who did not lead with Soleimani was a terrorist or a bad guy of some kind, but led with, I voted against Iraq. I knew what would happen in Iraq. We're not going to do that again. Pete Buttigieg gave a nothing statement. It said, you know, I have questions about how this decision was made. Well, you could say that about pretty much any decision ever made.
You could say that the crisis was triggered when the U.S. bombed and killed some Iran-sponsored militias in Iraq, which resulted in the storming of the embassy compound, which provoked the Soleimani assassination, which provoked the Iran missile attack, and whatever happens next. But didn't begin there. There's history to be reckoned with.
It's impossible to understand this at all without understanding how we got here over a long period of time. That the United States overthrew the democratic leader of Iran, who was moderate, within the lifetimes of presently living people, right, and installed a hated authoritarian leader and supported him, and also supported Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war, and so caused the deaths of countless Iranians during that war, and also shot down an Iranian civilian airliner and killed hundreds of people and then refused to apologize for it. So it's very bizarre when you hear Iran talked about as a place that just has this pathological hatred of us without any consideration of the context, any consideration of the fact that we've made it very clear that we intend to have nuclear weapons and we intend to allow Israel to have nuclear weapons, but we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. And from their perspective, obviously, that's incredibly menacing and threatening.
You suggest a sort of turn it around exercise. To imagine how everything would sound if the other side had said it.
So imagine that everything had occurred the other way around. Iraq had invaded the United States rather than the United States invading Iraq. They'd done so because we have weapons of mass destruction, which we actually do. And people in the United States had started violently resisting the occupying force. Would we classify that as terrorism? We probably wouldn't. We would classify that as legitimate resistance. Now, neighboring country, if Canada had come to assist us and then the top Canadian general had been assassinated, right, we would consider that an unlawful assassination. Terrorism and assassination look very, very different when they're seen through the other perspective.
Now, there was something else that you pointed out that I'd actually noticed myself, and it was a different sort of revisionist history using the power of suggestion to make a relatively anonymous villain, Soleimani, into a long-standing Osama bin Laden antichrist.
I mean, there are some profiles that appeared of him from time to time. And in fact, you know, they were very complimentary, right? Mainly because Soleimani was known for providing valuable assistance in the fight against ISIS.
Well, he also, I mean, just to be fair here, he also did create and fund proxy militias all over the region that were quite deadly and destabilizing. And he came to the aid of Assad in that brutal, grossly immoral regime's civil war.
Yes, he did. And that's important because actually what it really shows is that we don't care about things like that until we do, right? Saddam Hussein was committing horrible atrocities, right, throughout the 1980s, and the United States was supporting him. But all of a sudden, a switch flipped, and Saddam Hussein became public enemy number one. So then we go back and we go, look at all the atrocities he committed. So you often see that, this revisionist attempt to take someone who was always committing indefensible acts, but was our friend. And then when they're not our friend, suddenly we go, look at all the indefensible acts.
So all of these things you mentioned individually skew the reporting and they skew public perception. But the most pernicious effect, you say, is the aggregation of them, causing the public quickly to, if not accept the facts as presented by the government as gospel, but to accept the inevitability of war.
Yes, that's what's very dangerous. You get so far away from the underlying questions, so far away from the evidence. How are we going to respond is the question. And you don't say, I don't think we should respond, because if you say that, then you're saying, oh, well, you think that acts of terror can go unpunished. And with Iraq, if you go back and you look through all the media accounts during the build-up to Iraq, you see just how warped the debate became. It became, what should we do about Saddam Hussein? Not do we need to do anything about Saddam Hussein, but how much should we do? And then after the invasion, it became, is the invasion being managed well? And all of the questions became practical questions of, once again, strategy. So beware of the questions being framed. There was some general on MSNBC saying,
This is an appropriate response and what appeared to be a new phase of attacks on either the embassy or Americans in Iraq. So I think it was a great move.
So that was Barry McCaffrey, and I think General David Petraeus said something very similar.
Yeah, you'll hear it over and over and over.
What follows, you say, is a kind of sloganeering that takes hold. So it became almost inevitable that a Republican congressman would show up on cable news saying this.
Nancy Pelosi does it again, and her Democrats fall right in line. One, they're in love with terrorists. We see that. They mourn Soleimani more than they mourn our Gold Star families, who are the ones who suffered under Soleimani.
I mean, if you watch Fox News, you really see, like, let's go kick butt in Iran. Let's go show these people what we're made of. Because for a certain class of people in America who it won't affect, a war actually would be satisfying because they'll be shielded from all the consequences. They're not going to die in it. And so it's just an opportunity to feel powerful and win a game. That's how you see it talked about on Fox News. And that's what's really gross and upsetting. I shouldn't even say Fox News alone because it does permeate everywhere.
But what's left out of that kind of mentality is then what happens? Well, what happens is 20 years, trillion-dollar war, hundreds of thousands of deaths in Afghanistan, and ISIS coming out of the misadventure in Iraq.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. The Bush administration had no plan whatsoever. Their job was to depose Saddam Hussein, and when he was deposed, it was mission accomplished. It was all completely improvised with no knowledge of Iraqi culture, Iraqi government, Iraqi economics, nothing. They were thinking single-mindedly of that one objective of removing Saddam. And if you do that, I mean, it really does cause a disaster. So that's why you have to get away from this kind of looking solely at the moment or solely at one fact, like Soleimani's a bad guy, and start to think about historical context and what happens if you do something that feels satisfying and feels like justice, but ultimately might unravel into chaos.
Nathan, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. His article is called How to Avoid Swallowing War Propaganda.
Coming up, former generals with ties to the arms industry return to their media armchairs and the memification of World War III.
This is On the Media.